Hi, I'm Wayne McPhail, and I was one of the people that originally started the Rabble Podcast Network, and I think that you should support the Rabble Podcast Network and Rabble.ca because there's no other place where you're going to get such a diversity of voices speaking truth to power.
The Rabble Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Show your support by going to www.rabble.ca/donate.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
You're listening to Needs No Introduction, Fresh Ideas from Speakers of Note, a podcast of Rabble.ca. I'm Victoria Fenner. Today we bring you a compelling panel discussion called Music, Racism, Power, and Privilege 101. It was held at Music Gallery in Toronto last November 2015. There have been many discussions about power and privilege in the music community. A lot of those discussions have been wrought with hostility and animosity from all ends. There's racism in music. It's a tough discussion. And to move forward as a supportive, empathetic community of music creators, producers, listeners, and critics, and those of us in the media too, we need to have a better understanding of the systemic issues that are unique to Canada's multicultural landscape. The speakers raised some important perspectives and ideas, and we're happy that the organizers gave us permission to post this edited version of the evening. Thanks to chartattack.com for allowing us to use and edit their video stream. The panel discussion included Alaska B of Yemen Taka Sonic Titan, a Canadian experimental and performance art collective, Damien Abraham of the punk band Fucked Up, Simone Schmidt of Fiverr and the Highest Order, cellist Chris Dirksen, journalist Matt Mohinu, and media and culture sociologist Kim DeLatte. It's moderated and was organized by April Eliermo of Hooded Fang and Phaedra. Here now is Music, Racism, Power, and Privilege 101.
The reason why we put this together to begin with is because there have been a lot of discussions online about race and music, and a lot of people are tired of giving answers. A lot of people have questions. A lot of people are kind of, you know, in between and want to know more. So I think that it's important to, like, get those conversations offline and in person, make it more human, and just remember that, like, we do live and work and play beside each other and consume music together, and if we want to, you know, continue being part of a nice Canadian Toronto community, these are things that we should think about and acknowledge. We're not going to solve anything overnight or change anybody's minds overnight. It takes a long time of and effort of learning and internalizing things like racism and the issues surrounding it, especially in our scene. We're basically, like, all looking at ourselves and, you know, rethinking about our identities and our perspectives. But if a small handful of people can leave today considering another perspective, I think it's a good small baby step towards, you know, having a empathetic, inclusive community. So I just want to also thank again the panelists for doing this. You know, we're all musicians and music critics and consumers, and we're not anti-racist experts. We don't have all the answers, but we I know a little bit because of our perspectives and the work that we put in. So we're going to try our best to answer the anonymous questions that have been put forth. So I'm April. I play bass in Hooded Fang and vocals and machines in Phaedra, and try to be a positive community educator when I can.
My name is Chris Dirksen. I am a half-Cree, half-Mennonite cellist. I have had the privilege of being a full-time musician for 14 years. And like April said, I really am a bit nervous to be up here because I don't feel like any expert, and I don't just... Let's have open minds and hearts going forward.
I'm Simone Schmidt. I'm a songwriter. I'm a settler on Indigenous land, and I guess I play a lot of country music too. a lot of white people mostly in a pretty segregated scene. So thanks for inviting me to talk.
My name is Max Mohenyu. I'm a contributor at Portals, Pitchfork. I work with bands on creative direction and styling, and I'm also working on my own music and a book. So happy to be here tonight.
I'm Alaska B. I am the drummer and one of the founders of Yamantaka Sonic Titan. I'm an illustrator, audio engineer, a couple other things.
I'm Damien. I am a parent of three. I sing in a band called Fucked Up. I make weed documentaries for Vice, and I'm a failed VJ. I'm here to learn.
My name is Kim DeLotte, and I'm a PhD student in sociology, and I study the intersection of culture and equality, and I focus in particular on the music industry. I'm a mom of one, and I, too, am here to learn.
Thanks. Can we welcome the panelists? So before we dive into the questions, Kim, the sociologist, is going to do a very short lecture on racism and music, just to define and clarify some terms and provide some understanding of where we're coming from when we answer questions. And again, thank you, Chris, for reminding us that we should be here with open minds and open hearts, because this is very sensitive for a lot of people to talk about or think about and reflect upon. So, Kim?
And thanks to April. This took a lot of work to pull together, and we're all very grateful that you took the time to do it. So, and to everyone else behind the scenes as well, because a lot of work goes into these events. So I've been tasked to just speak briefly towards some of the ways that racism gets reproduced in the music scene. And we're all familiar with the more explicit ways that racism gets reproduced. So I'm just briefly going to talk towards some of the more subtle or implicit ways that racism gets reproduced. And this might be common knowledge for some of you, and for that I apologize. But my hope is that for those of you that are new to conversations about race, this can provide an entry point. So the first thing I wanted to talk about is white privilege. And basically, that's referring to societal benefits that are enjoyed by white people, often to the disadvantage of non-white people. Privilege is about your culture being the one that's ubiquitous, being the norm. And by virtue of your culture being the norm, that means that other cultures are treated as not the norm, as somehow different or foreign, and there are implications for that. White privilege is also about a lot of positive stereotypes being attributed to you on the basis of your skin color, regardless of whether or not they're warranted. So one way of thinking about it is kind of as an invisible wind that just kind of pushes certain white people along through life, and it just kind of projects you forward. So some examples of what this looks like include going to a store and not being treated as suspicious, not being followed around by clerks. Opening up a history book and seeing your history represented in a positive way, and just widespread representation in books in general, in children's books, for example. It's about the fact that white things don't require a special category. When you go to the grocery store, there's not a section for white people food. There's the implication as well is that we don't need specialty channels or our own magazines because all magazines are for us and represent us. That's also a form of white privilege. And it's about having, for example, flesh-colored pantyhose actually match your skin tone, since having a white skin tone is considered flesh tone for a lot of hygiene and cosmetic products. So those are some examples. And of course, privilege isn't all or nothing. You can be privileged in some ways and not in others. You might be a well-off person of color, but still disadvantaged in the fact that you go out in the world and you don't necessarily see people in positions of power that look like you, or you open a magazine and you don't see yourself reflected. So it becomes very hard to see what pathways are available to you. So those are some examples. And now, how then does privilege play out in the music community? Well, I'm going to give you an example from my own past. Out of university, I scored an internship at a major record label in A&R and marketing. And I got it because my sister had a friend that worked in another department, and she was able to put in a good word for me. Obviously, I don't want to downplay my own ability. I mean, I obviously did somewhat okay in the interview to score the job, but suffice it to say, my social network, my social capital, really advantaged me in this particular instance. It was a good internship. It was competitive. It was one that a lot of people wanted, and it led to full-time employment, so I was really lucky. Now, at the same record label, there is a department called the street team. It was a street team marketing department, and they were responsible for a lot of the more kind of informal ways of marketing, like postering and flyering. And that department was comprised primarily of people of color. And the problem with that department is that there was very little room for upward mobility. And so by virtue of my network, I was able to kind of land into a particular place and have a shot at getting a promotion, whereas someone who is a visible minority, for example, will use their network, but since there are more visible minorities located in this particular department, it makes them more likely to get a job in that department. And so you see how one's social network plays into your life chances. And that's, you know, again, that's a form of white privilege. There's lots of evidence that shows that our social networks tend to represent our own race, ethnicity. So that's one example. And the fact that white social networks get reproduced, it happens in culture industries all the time, and that's one of the main reasons why white perspectives are so overrepresented in TV, music, and so forth. A second way that racism gets perpetuated is through cultural appropriation. And this is basically the practice of adopting elements from one culture, typically a marginalized or a racialized culture, and using those elements in your own culture without acknowledging the context from which they came. So pop culture examples include, well, basically the whole genre of rock and roll, but more specifically, Led Zeppelin famously plagiarized songs from African-American blues artists and didn't give them credit, at least not at the outset. And I'm going to show you some images of what cultural appropriation looks like. At the risk of, in fact, perpetuating racism by putting these images on display, I'm actually hoping that just by demonstrating them to you, we can reinforce why, in fact, they're wrong and inappropriate. So my apologies for showing you offensive material. So here we have, here we have Katy Perry wearing cornrows. Same with Kesha. And here's an image of Taylor Swift. This one really goads me. I don't know why. Anyway. This is appropriation because these women are benefiting from aspects of black culture that black people themselves get derided for. There are studies that show that black women who wear traditional black hairstyles are less likely to get jobs. But here we have white women taking elements of this and elements that have been traditionally been mocked and using them to their benefit, to their advantage. And they're being celebrated for it. So that's why it's cultural appropriation. Examples from our scene. This shouldn't require much explanation. This is a photo of some white people wearing headdresses to a concert. Headdresses have a sacred and ceremonial role in First Nations communities, and you have to bestow with a certain position and honor to wear them, and so removing them from that context is just disrespectful. And lastly, in the case of the band Viet Cong, they took something, a guerrilla political organization that is a fraught part of Vietnamese history, and they used it outside of its historical context, again, for their own benefit for their band name, which you could argue is kind of their brand. So white privilege and cultural appropriation were the two more implicit ways, and oftentimes explicit, ways that racism gets perpetuated in our music scene. And That's all I have to say about that.
That's perfect. Thanks, Kimmy. So in case you didn't know, we set up a website online where people can send in anonymous questions. And we're going to just go through all 18 of them. The first one is, I'm just going to read them verbatim. Is it really offensive for a white person to enjoy singing hip-hop rap and succeed at it and be rewarded for it? I do believe that they must be respectful of its origins and will be and be willing to engage in everything hip-hop stands for. But often it seems that many members of the black community are offended or insulted by such an event because they feel it is strictly black music. I believe this mentality will continue to divide us. I believe it should be celebrated when other cultures or races enjoy and wish to engage in a form of music that historically belonged to one culture or race. It should be celebrated that they appreciate the music so much that they wish to excel at it, just as much as if a member of the black community were to develop an interest in, say, country music, which is very historically white. If they enjoy that type of music and want to perform it, they should be able to do so proudly, and the country music community should be flattered. This is the one way we can become one. This is obviously a comment, not a question, but we're going to address it anyway.
Just to let you all know, we got these questions just a few days ago and kind of divvied them up very quickly between ourselves.
So I guess I was asked to go first. So first of all, a disclaimer, I'm not black, so I don't feel like I can really weigh in directly upon this hip-hop and rap situation that they're proposing. But I will say in response to that first and foremost, Eminem had the full support of Dr. Dre and his entire crew. And he's like the biggest white rapper and possibly one of the biggest rappers of all time. So I don't understand what this question is even about when it comes to that, because this is not how I see the history of it. I do believe that, personally, that if you excel at any one thing, that I don't necessarily believe that culture or race should be a barrier. Though I will say that those who might feel otherwise are very likely justified on some level, and maybe dialogue is needed. But what I can say is that a person who's mixed, just as we were talking about privilege earlier, I have to say that I have a white father, and I am privileged enough that he was a rock musician in the 70s. So I had this support to go and follow my dreams of playing music, which is really not a very ideal job, for one. And my mother was Chinese, which definitely means that I know how to play music because I was kind of forced to study it. But what I can say is that when I was at home, I had never perceived there being any barriers on my ability to achieve in any genre or any like form of music that I chose to pursue. I was just as much supported in pursuing like making power noise as I would be playing like classical sonatas on solo piano. But I can say that the moment that I left that environment, that's not exactly what I've been met with. So as this person's proposing that, you know, some people in the black community feel this way, I think really you should ask yourself, maybe people feel like this all over the place, and that this isn't like an isolated thing about black people versus white people, but this is just a consistent form of tribalism where, you know, people say, well, what does a rock band look like? You see four dudes, you see Boston, you know, you see that thing. And that's fine. Like, this is a historical image. It was branded, it was sold. If you have this perception, it's been proposed to you. But I would say that, you know, this is a universal issue in any genre. And you know what? I mean, every time we talk about PC, you know, what's politically correct and what's not, everybody says, oh, it should be a meritocracy. So if it's a meritocracy, then, you know, like, why is it a meritocracy only for white people's entry into perceived non-white genres? Like, why does it not cut both directions? Like, I can't say that I've necessarily been supported in joining like a white rock community, though I've definitely been tolerated and been successful, and I actually owe that a lot to the privilege of not being afraid of doing it anyways.
Thanks, Alaska. Simone, I think you wanted to add to that.
Oh, I can just speak to the fact that country music is not historically white music, and that this is actually, I think, contained in the question is an answer, which is that, you know, like Blind Lemon Jefferson originated country blues. I mean, a lot of African slaves originated country blues, and it was appropriated. A.P. Carter, who's like the father of country music, was taught by an African-American teacher. So I think that it's important to recognize that when country records started being made in the 1920s and 30s, hillbilly music was marketed to white people and played not only by white people, but for all they could tell from the liner notes, possibly by white people. And also, then there was race records, and those were African-American players. And they were marketed to African-American consumers. So I think it's really important to recognize that, like, implicit in this question is an entire history of, like, erasure of the black roots of country music. So, yeah, I don't blame people for being protective of their art forms at all, because wouldn't you?
Thanks. Thanks, Simone. I think I just want to add that when people are consuming cultures outside of theirs, I think it depends how thoughtful it is, and maybe that would be a, you know, very basic answer to that question. So our second question is, a friend recently assembled a band and noticed they were lacking people of color and had someone in mind but didn't want to merely seek out one person of color just to have that box checked. In other words, they didn't want to use a person of color simply for their own peace of mind or to tokenize this person. They did end up having a woman as part of the band lineup, but I was just kind of wondering if you think tokenizing is bad or as bad as a 100% lack of presence.
Hi, it's me again. I'm going to continue where I left off. So yeah, this question, what I have to say first and foremost to the person writing this is that they said that they didn't even approach that person of color because they were afraid of tokenizing them, so that person then didn't get an opportunity. So I kind of go like I don't even know how to say to that. Does anybody else see that? I don't know. But when it comes to the end of it, when they're saying like, is tokenizing bad or as bad as 100% lack of presence? I think you have to stop and ask yourself, like, you know, like what, in an equal world where people weren't like being promoted with different cultural environments or different societal forces, you'd think people would just kind of gravitate towards whatever they wanted to do. And I would assume that statistically, under that kind of environment, you'd think that there would be kind of like an equal balance of all people for anything. This is like an ideal equal world. Obviously, this is not achievable. But if you think of it like that and you go, how come everybody I know is white and I'm asking them to be in my band and I can't find a person of color without feeling like I'm tokenizing them? I just feel like there's ample musicians of color that you can just say, yo, you want to play? And they'll just do it. Like, I feel like there shouldn't even be this worry. Like, I don't think a group of white dudes should be like, oh, crap, like, we really need, like a brown person, or we're going to go out there and we're getting so much trouble. Like, I don't think that they should do that. I don't think anybody should. Like, I don't think that this solves any problems whatsoever. But I can say that playing in Yamataka Sonic Titan over, like, 7 or 8 years, I can say that we've collaborated with well over 30, 40 musicians and performers, who, all of which I think 2 were Caucasian in all that time. So I really did not have to try or even filter very hard to find those people. They're everywhere. It's more about the networks in society that prevent people from meeting people. It's not about making the perfect, like, yeah, genetically pure band or something.
For sure. And I think that... Thanks, Alaska. I think the question is totally valid because...
For sure.
You know, people want to have... you know, proper representation, but still want to have the aesthetic or music aesthetic or style that they're looking for. So I
just think we're talented enough as people of color, as anybody else, so that we don't actually need any kind of tokenism when choosing your band. I think
sure.
that we're just probably your best choices sometimes,
yeah,
and
totally.
You should just go for it.
I mean, all I'd say is that if it's even a question, you failed already. Like, if you have to go, oh, you know, like, we should really have a black guy. And it's like, you know, any project I've been a part of, you know, music, art, anything, you know, it's been 100% organic. You know, they know what I bring to the table as a person of color, you know, my experience, my history, like, whatever it is. And they just kind of go, okay, we should collaborate on something. I feel like if anyone ever came to me and was like, oh, you know, yeah, I have this thing, and, like, yeah, we, like, need someone who's, like, black, I'd be like, okay, no. Like, it would just be, like, a no-brainer. So I guess for this question, I would say, you know, if you have friends that you know are just naturally talented, then ask them to be in a group with you. But if you have to actually, like, have a talent search and be like, oh, black people only, or brown people only, or we really need an Asian person, it's like you're not really doing yourself self-service. For me, it's almost, I'd rather there be no presence, because it's not organic. It's you trying to get some sort of image or aesthetic, or, like, you know, if I had, like, a group fronted by, like, a Asian person or a female person, like it's just, the focus is lost at that point. I'm automatically just looking at you and going, well, you did a really weird thing, when it should have been as easy as, let's just make some art and let's collaborate, you know?
Yeah.
So when you have to think about it, it kind of just, yeah,
for
you kind
of. It sounds like there has to be a balance of, you know, being friends with people and thinking about how you like their, you know, the way they play, and, you know, being conscious of representation in your band. Thanks.
Unless you're gorillas, because then Noodle has to be an Asian woman. Do you remember this, the racialized cartoons? And they would just grab anybody who was the same race as the cartoon characters?
Yeah, it's a tricky question.
It's a rock and roll joke.
Okay, thanks, Alaska and Max. The next question is, I have lived in North America. Okay, a lot of these questions are half comments, but we want to give people a voice. So, I have lived in North America for 15 years, and in Canada, 5 years of those. I have attended the underground music scene, experimental, noise, sound, art, and I have seen that most of the artists are white, Anglo-Saxon, and males. I rarely see a black person or even a person from other ethnicities, Asian, Latinos, etc. I have seen groups of many, mainly white kids, hipsters, gathering at bars where only or mainly white people attend. I see a contradiction of white hipsters and ideology of changing paradigms. Instead of really supporting the little guy, independent artist, they only support each other and relegate the other.
All right. So this question / comment really covers a giant gamut of things that we are talking about. And what I think is important to take out of this question comment is the two main things are community and inclusivity, and community and inclusivity within specific genres as well. And then the third beast within this comment is talking about the Anglo-Saxon male within music. And quick music history lesson for North America, it's been happening since the monks. I think when we are talking, we are all, I guess the best way for me to say this is we are all treaty people, so we all have to work together here. So it's them versus us versus them is in a way to begin a community, inclusivity conversation to begin with. I think both sides of the door have to be open. I think also inclusivity within the music industry or exclusivity within the music industry is a huge, huge, huge topic. In so many of our own communities, we are inclusive to ourselves and we are exclusive to ourselves. And this happens through all of our communities. And it's about opening that door between our combined communities, which I think this conversation is really should be talking about, and how we build a community of mixed race music lovers, creators, and appreciators. And it's huge, right? I think a really good example is my friend Rosina right there. Started this really rad project I got to be a part of last year called Bold as Love. And this project, we only got 1 year of funding, but we're still going to do it. What it did, we brought Indigenous performers and people of color performers together and created our own community
And it was a really beautiful, beautiful thing. So I think if we're talking about community and inclusivity, I think where it starts is with us creating it together.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's a lot of work to open those doors and bridge communities. It takes a lot of effort and work and awkwardness. Last year, my band Phaedra, it's electronic pop, we threw a concert and we played with a hip-hop artist from Brampton, and we played with these teenage punks. And so there were the usual Phaedra concert goers, these hip-hop people from Brampton, and these teenage punks that had to go to school the next day. And we were all in one venue, and you could tell everyone was taken aback and a little uncomfortable, but everyone had a great time. And some of them became Facebook friends. Warmed my heart. But it took a lot of work and organizing and just like research, you know, and taking that risk to open the door and bridge those gaps. Did anyone else want to add anything?
I guess I'm speaking from the perspective of someone in the folk country scene where segregation is alive, very much alive. And I'll play to entirely white audiences regularly. And I think that it's can be very much reflective of a segregation that exists in society in general. But I guess I'm addressing white people in the audience where I'm we live on stolen land and we have to decolonize, and that starts on the inside. I think a lot of the time I'm embarrassed to mix my friends because I'll be oh, shit. I have friends who say racist things and we talk about it, or they stop being my friends. But it's kind of I don't want to mix them with my friends of color, and I feel like that's just my honest truth. And so they're really, if you live in Toronto, you're in an amazing situation, because to decolonize and to decenter your self from narratives in general is really possible, because there's all this amazing art and music going on that doesn't necessarily have to do with our identity as white settlers. We can go to Bold as Love, for instance, and meet other people who are making great music. And I think that there's amazing treaty. What's the Talking Treaties event that Ange Loft is doing right now, if you want to write it down? And it educates us about our treaty obligations, the agreements that we're tacitly part of right now with Indigenous people. I think people really have to start taking that seriously, not as history, but as our current condition. But I also think that, in general, it has to be understood that when you're invited into a space, it's a gift, and so take that opportunity and expose yourself to other people. I think it's good.
Yeah, I think you should try and do that, even though it's scary and awkward and uncomfortable.
One sentence.
Sure.
One sentence. Basically, you should look at it just like countries do. If you don't take advantage of an immigration of ideas and concepts from elsewhere in the world, then all you're doing is cutting yourself off from all the possible benefits of it. And if capitalism, something so blind and soul-crushing, can see that immigration and integration of new ideas actually means a positive fiscal outlook, then I think that in our scenes, if we're saying, I don't actually care if the white hipster scene lets us in because it's their loss, I think that most of the non-white interesting movements have happened in isolation outside of those movements because of that. So I say that you're just shooting yourself in the foot.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Alaska.
Yeah, I don't think we are none of, there's no race that is free of guilt of being,
completely 100% inclusive. We are all guilty of doing this on all sides of our colors.
Thanks. Can I say one more thing?
Okay.
I also think that it's a problem because people have different reasons for playing music, and some people believe music is sacred, or they think it's like for a party, or it's like for community, and other people want to make money off music. Mm. And so people who just want to make money off music are going to just try to make money off music. They're not treating it like a community. So I think that a lot of the time, like even in the whole Viet Cong situation, like people were talking about the Canadian music, indie music community, and I was like, what community is that? Like, I don't know who is configuring like that as a community. To me, it's just a bunch of people doing music business.
Yeah, that's a good point. And the next question is related to this question that we've just been talking about. Despite Toronto's reputation as a highly multicultural city, it seems most of our successful music exports, labels, and festivals are within the white, male-dominated genre of indie rock, punk, hardcore. What can we do to foster more diverse genres and identities in our music scene? Again, we don't have all the answers, but we have some ideas. These are, like, serious questions.
Want to go? Or do you want me? Anybody?
I thought...
We have Chris on the
docket. Oh, did we skip one?
Yeah, I think we skipped
two. Well, this is great. You know what? This is exactly the same, kind of exactly the same question as what we had just talked about. And so I guess, like, I'm just going to repeat myself a little bit, how do we make our community more inclusive? And that's not a question I can answer, because that's a conversation we all have together. But I definitely, for me, I think community is like based around who I surround myself with. So I surround myself with people of like-minded folk, and we are all crazy together in our same crazy trajectory. What else did
I could chime in.
Well... Yeah, I think it's up to each individual person to create their own path, especially in the music industry. This is not a passive career if you want to be a part of this career. It's a very, very active career. You have to take and make your own path any way you do. There's no right way to make a living in this. And I think by having the most amount of friends is a really good way to go. And how do you have a lot of friends? You're open, you're inclusive, you seek out other people. Yeah.
I'm thinking, like, when I read this question and it says, like, it seems most of our successful music exports, labels, and festivals are within the white male-dominated genre of indie rock, et cetera. I don't know if that's true. Like, I think that's maybe a perception that comes from being in a particular environment. Because, like, I mean, I've been to the Players Prize, and... I mean, Drake never shows up, but he's always there. And I go, like, even within, like, this white male-dominated indie circle, Drake is still loved by everybody. Like, I feel like, Dan, you wouldn't stop singing Hotline Bling. Like, it's just like nobody will stop. Like, so I don't know where this is coming from. I think there's also a long history of, like, pop hits being turned out of this city. I think this, simplifying it to punk and hardcore, I don't even think... Whenever I think of Canadian big successful punk bands, I actually think of Vancouver. I don't know where this person's talking about. But I definitely think that there is a lot happening here, and I think this is oversimplifying it.
I think you're right. It depends on where you go and consume music, because there is a lot of diversity being exported out of Canada.
And I think it speaks to that separation that we have.
Damien, we have one more minute to answer that question.
I just want to add one quick point. I think maybe... the way we have to restructure the way funding goes out in this country. Mm-hmm. A lot of these labels, they get direct board of approval, focus on white genres, typically populated by white artists and stuff like that. And I think a lot of labels that would focus on music that's normally associated with people of color don't necessarily get the same sort of funding and don't have the same opportunities to export their music that are presented to some of these, especially indie music.
Thank you. That's a great point. So... you know, it's a structural problem. Okay, so...
It's not?
No, arts funding, council funding, a lot of people...
No, absolutely.
I think he's referring to Factor.
I'm talking about Factor funding, Direct Board of Approval, specifically.
Yeah, because OAC is much broader than music.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I was talking specifically about music. Other arts funding, I don't know as much about, but with Factor.
Yeah, Factor and what you said, direct and all sorts of arts, music,
definitely focused towards rock, indie rock.
And they also require, like, dollars to play the game on, like, the OAC. Like, the OAC is not even what we're talking about, like, Factor. They look at how much money you make with the money they give you. And also, like, you can't even get a video grant unless you can prove that you already have enough money to pay for the video. And then they'll subsidize it, which means you've already paid for everything. So, yeah, there is, like, a huge barrier there. And if you, you know, look at, like, statistics of who can access this kind of funding, it's not very pretty. Though I will say the OAC does a pretty good job.
I want to speak towards what Damien was saying, and actually it segues back into question number four.
So question number four is, we need to widen the musical parameters in public broadcasts so that if it is more reflective of the actual ethnicities now living in Canada, how would we go about initiating that successfully, successful being the key ingredient?
Okay, so in answering this question, I'm going to assume this person is talking about commercial radio, which may or may not be the case, so my apologies if I've misinterpreted that. So
it says public, though.
Sorry?
It does say public broadcast, though.
Well, we can talk towards the CBC as well. But so the first thing I want to mention is that there was this research done by this sociologist in the U.S. named Gabriel Rossman. He's a big data analyst, and he basically did this very sophisticated analysis that could account for why certain songs become hits on the radio and why certain songs diffuse between different radio stations. And it's a surprise. It's not that radio stations listen to listener feedback and are playing the songs that listeners actually want to hear. It's based on the extent to which a song conforms to a specific genre, because radio stations are very formulaic. And the other big reason was the influence of radio stations. And we were talking about this and the side room. I'm not sure if most of you are aware, but payola is alive and well. The act of radio stations the act of record labels paying radio stations to play hit songs still goes on. It happens both explicitly and then in more soft, subtle ways through like free concert tickets and things like that. To a lesser extent in Canada, but you could imagine that it probably still happens here as well. So in answering this question, then, how do we go about increasing inclusivity and getting a more diverse range of music and people on the radio? The 50-year plan would be getting radio stations and record labels to hire more people of color, with the hope that those people are going to bring with them a more diverse interest in different kinds of music and in turn kind of influence things down the line. So that would be like the ideal 50-year long-term plan. But in Canada, we also have the benefit of government intervention. So another thing we can do is change CanCon rules. Right now, radio stations are mandated to play 35% Canadian content, but to the best of my knowledge, and correct me if I'm wrong, our radio station could play Nickelback 35% of the time and still be meeting CanCon stipulations, which is crazy, which is ridiculous. You got to ask, what's the point, really? And so we could introduce a stipulation where some of that 30% has to be dedicated to playing the music of emerging artists, and hope that within that subsection of emerging artists, there are more people of color represented and a more diversity of genres represented. Now, how do we increase the amount of diverse emerging artists? To Damien's point, we changed the way that music funding gets doled out. And I, too, am thinking about Factor in particular, because there is it's less explicit now. Before, acts that got Factor funding were expected to repay some of the money they received, whether or not in principle, at least symbolically. So what that means is that the acts that were anticipated to do well economically were rewarded more money. And I actually did a little pilot study several years ago, and I'm hoping to pick this up and follow through with this research, but I looked at acts receiving more than $10,000 in Factor funding, and surprise, surprise, it's predominantly rock and roll and alt-country musicians who are white. So those are two concrete ways we could try and increase diversity. Now, we're relying on the government to do it, but that is kind of one advantage we have in Canada. So those are some ideas.
Thanks, Kim. So the next question is, freedom of expression is crucial in the expression of art. Do you think there is room to express racist or misogynistic views through an artistic medium without inciting hate? If so, how? And who decides what is an appropriate degree of expression and what is going too far? I know it seems crazy to some of us, but this is like a real wondering that a person has, you know?
Yeah, so
we should, be respectful of the questions because people
These are people's actual valid concerns, and absolutely understand. This is a really tough one to answer. So unlike the U.S., there free speech isn't as protected here. So it is legally in Canada you can place limits on free speech, but it all depends on how that gets interpreted and indeed how what gets defined as hate speech. But basically, no one is going to legally restrict your desire to be an asshole, right? So people are able to say hateful things, for the most part, in music and art and get away with it. But the consequence is people are going to get ticked off and people are going to mobilize and respond. And that's just the kind of the push and pull of the art world we live in. Now, if something were to cross a line and, say, try, you know, motivate a hate crime, then, you know, then that would change things. But ultimately, we're always going to have this push and pull. I think the Action Bronson example is one of the more recent ones where we saw how that played out, right? People mobilized and they decided that they didn't want, you know, that being represented, his music being represented, and his lyrics, I should say, being represented in a public space. And so that's just the way it works. I don't really see another way around it.
Yeah, I think that if you are choosing to express racist and misogynistic views in your art and music, it probably will incite a feeling of hate. Yeah, just, you know.
That's one thing I don't get about. I think that's the only part of the question that kind of makes me shake my head, because it's like, you're saying, like, how, like, when you're asking, like, how to do this without inciting hate, I'm like, why do you want to know how? Like, because yeah. If they want to do that, I'm all for it. I'm like, come at me, bro. Write the meanest thing you can. Just do it. But at the end of the day, it's like, I'm like, they don't care about what we think because they're writing a racist and misogynistic record, so.
It's true. If you had a band that was, I don't know, a Nazi band, and they were like, we are Nazis, you're like, okay, you're racist, you're Nazis, stay away from me, you know?
Unless it's meant as, like, meta-social commentary and the person's trying to actually, intends it to be a form of satire. But you just have to be very careful about the way you represent your ideas, and you're going to be held accountable to them, right?
Yes?
In punk and hardcore, a lot of people try and do that satire thing, and it always falls on its face. It's like, just avoid it. Just don't do it. Like, you can say whatever you want, but you're going to be an asshole.
Yeah.
People are going to look at you as being an asshole. But...
And you will get called out.
Pardon me?
And you will get called out.
You get called out.
You get called out.
That's called freedom of expression.
Yeah. So I think I think the answer is you can't do that. but I would like to thank that person for really thinking about it and being honest and open, because it's a real thing that they're thinking about. And they can maybe go and do some further research, you know, following this.
Also, like, leave the satire to someone who's actually lived through it.
Thanks. Yeah, good point. Okay, so next question is, can we please have a moratorium on white soul singers making it big and being heralded as trailblazers, at least until some balance is restored?
Okay.
Yes, no, maybe?
Oh, okay. So... It's funny because I was really trying to think about this question. I was with my roommate and we were talking, and, you know, it's a tough one because at the end of the day, like, as long as there's been music, as long as, you know, people have been recording music, making music, like, there's things that, like, unless, you know, historically it's actually African music or this music or this music, something very specific, it's like you can't really say that, like, you know, I don't know, it's tough. Like, I'm trying to figure out how to answer this properly.
Not to cut.
No, no, go for it, go for it.
It's all stolen. All popular music is stolen from black music. Like like it all is. Like rock and roll, you go right down through the history. You can go on YouTube and you look up like first rock and roll records. There's records from 1935 that sound like rock and roll that would come out and be credited to like Bill Haley like 20 years later. So it's all stolen. So that has to be reconciled first before anything else can
totally.
And also this idea of like restoring a balance. I mean, at the end of the day, I feel like, you know, as people of color, like we're always going to make the music that's represents us. We're always going to do our thing. And, you know, I've had friends like, you know, I remember I was in New York and my friend, you know, he was discouraged because like his record wasn't really getting any plays. And he's like, you know, I just feel so weird that like, as a black male that, you know, I have to have, you know, white bloggers or journalists, you know, saying that, oh, you know, my music isn't as good as, like, you know, like How to Dress Well or, like, any of these artists that are kind of making a name for themselves using sort of soul, R&B type sounds. But, I mean, it's also one of those things where it's, like, that's for, you know, white media and, like, a lot of publications. That's just the most, that's easier for them to digest. You know, like, a lot of people just... It's sort of easier for them, like, when a white person does it. Like, you know, that's why, like, this whole, like, sort of alt R&B thing has taken off. Because, like, you know, it's sort of easier when, like, a white person does something as opposed to, like, you know... I don't know. I think for me it's, like... Ultimately, I just feel like, you know, this idea of, like, trailblazing, like...
I wanted to say something about that. I wanted to say that the term trailblazer, I was talking about this with Ange Loft, that the term trailblazing is a colonial term about like exploring like this new place that's you've never been to before. I mean, it's like, as a Canadian, especially with the Group of Seven, we should be very cognizant of like how you can use these minor artistic things in order to really push a colonial agenda. And as far as saying like there are white people being trailblazers in Seoul, I'm just like, the Righteous Brothers, like, this is so old that your grandpa probably had this conversation at this point. Like, there's been so many white people in Seoul. It's almost like they want to have. It's almost like we want to have this conversation so that this time we're gonna win it. Like, that's how I feel about it. I don't know.
And also, just like thinking about different genres. Like, you know, Bad Brains is like one of the biggest.
Sorry, who?
Like Bad Brains is like one of the biggest punk bands there is. Like, you know, and they're all black men. Mm-hmm. You know, like, so it's just like this idea of like, you know, oh, white people taking souls. Like, no one can really take anything. You know, we're all sort of making music and we're all sort of making moves. And, like, obviously, you know, my one thing is, like, if the motive is pure and you're a good musician and you've studied, I'm good with that. You know, like, my roommate studied, like, a bunch of different African music and is, like, and he's, like, amazing at what he does. And he's a white guy. But my whole thing is, like, you know, I learned so much more from him that I learn from anyone else, you know, and I don't even question it, like, oh, like, why did you study this? It's like, no, like, he's good at what he does, so I just take that at face value, you know what I mean? I think it's this idea of, like, you know...
There's also something, like, there's a difference between this new term I heard is cultural diffusion versus cultural appropriation. Mm-hmm. And cultural diffusion happens naturally with all of our mixings with each other, and that's a natural process that happens. Yeah. And it's art. We're talking about art here. We take things that we like and we make it our own. But appropriation definitely comes from a place of power and taking, as opposed to diffusion and influenced.
Also, I think, like, let's talk about Adele and just be like, Adele is dominating. Like, this is the way that we talk about pop culture and, like, dominating the charts. And I guess the way that I approach music is not really that I want to dominate, but that's, like, what capitalism and the music industry want for bands is, like, full saturation, just, like, you can't ignore it. And I think that's really unhealthy. But I'm an anti-capitalist, so
and,
I don't know.
And music, the music industry itself is completely, is a business based on capitalism and
white supremacy.
Appropriation. Right. And it has a very, very long history of that.
Before I pose the next question, I just wanted to say that I personally invited everybody on this panel because I know them to be conscious people and people who think about these things in their daily lives. And I wanted to invite a few different perspectives based on like experience and where people are coming from. So the next question is, why does there need to be white people on a panel about race? What do they have to add to the discussion? And then a related question is, why do we think it is necessary to include non-ethnic people unproportionately in a conversation about race? Or Kim?
I could start.
Do you, Kim?
It was really weird when all those questions started coming in, because I mean there was a lot of them sort of specifically targeted towards Damien. And I think for me, when I think of like, you know, the supreme ally, I think it's someone who's like consistent, someone who, you know, is consistently trying to educate themselves, trying to educate, you know, other people around them, trying to continue to do things in our city and our community that promote diversity, that promote sort of being inclusive. And, you know, for me, like when I heard that Damien was going to be on the panel, it was a no-brainer, because, you know, it's someone who's been consistent in wanting to help educate people. And I mean, especially like in the punk scene, like, you know, there's a lot of racism. And I mean, even when I was going to punk shows when I was younger, there's a lot of racism that I faced. So it's like, you know, for me, I think the best voice, especially for what we're talking about tonight, it would be someone like Damien. So I think it's very important to have someone.
Yeah, it's true. And I think that for me, it's also important to have a straight white male ally who can speak about their privilege, because there's a small handful of people in my life that are vocal about acknowledging it.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that on the one hand, I don't think it's fair for all of this work to fall on people of color, right? Especially since such a large part of the problem is white privilege. And so we need white people to speak out towards that. At the same time, I don't want to come across as patronizing or take away from the voices of people of color. So it's a constant push and pull and trying to be aware of how much I'm speaking, to whom I'm speaking, and be respectful of the conversations as well. So it's I will say, like, I'll admit, it's intimidating. I remember being in my early 20s and kind of being exposed to feminism and anti-racism for the first time and being intimidated as to how I could join those conversations, because the people that were really entrenched in them were really pissed off, and rightly so. But for someone who comes from like a small white town who doesn't have that exposure, it's hard to find an entry point, but it's so important for white people to be involved but be respectful at the same time.
Yeah, I think there's a delicate balance between giving space for the voices of people of color that don't normally get to be out there to speak, and for these voices who are constantly having to explain why things are offensive or racist to not have to do the work all the time. So I think that this panel, you know, I mean, it's half white, and it's like that means half the work is already being unloaded off of people of color.
You've been listening to an edited version of Music, Racism, Power, and Privilege 101, moderated and organized by April Eliermo. The event was held on November 24th, 2015, at the Music Gallery in Toronto. Thanks to chartattack.com for permission to bring this edited version of the evening to our rabble.ca listeners. If you want to see the presentation as well as listen to it, you can also go to Rabble TV, Dateline January 20th, 2016. A link is provided in the show notes for this podcast. Thanks to Kavesh B for his help in preparing this item for the Rabble Podcast Network. You've been listening to Needs No Introduction, Fresh Ideas from Speakers of Note, a production of Rabble.ca. I'm Victoria Fenner. Thanks for listening.